Welcome to the On Humans podcast. This is your host, Ilari Mäkelä. Today's episode explores the relationship between ethics and evolution, between humanism and Darwinism. Our guest is Philip Kitcher. He is a professor of philosophy at Columbia University and someone who has thought about these issues very deeply, engaging both in rigorous and technical work in philosophy of biology, but also someone who has written with warmth and with wit about humanism, ethics, and the future of faith. We touch upon questions such as, what is morality? Is it like a science which discovers new truths about the world? Or perhaps like a fashion, which simply funnels the sentiments of the prevailing era? What is even the point of morality in a broadly scientific Darwinian view of looking at our species? We continue to Kitcher's famous criticism of sociobiology, nowadays better known as evolutionary psychology, asking whether evolution has proven that we are all selfish. Or on the other hand, is there anything that evolution can actually tell us about humans? We finish with a discussion on secular humanism, faith, and the future of religion. As always, there is a full list of all the names and technical terms mentioned that you can find in the show notes. I hope that you enjoy the conversation. I bring to you Philip Kitcher. Professor Philip Kitcher, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's fun to be here.
In your books, Ethical Project and Moral Progress, you try to make sense of ethics within a broadly scientific worldview. You want to maintain that societies can become better ethically, morally, and I guess in the same sense, they can also become worse ethically, morally. You want to maintain that the abolition of slavery, as an example, was true moral progress. Now, what exactly is the challenge that you're responding to?
So I think that people have a fair amount of common ground about particular examples of ethical progress, but I don't think we have a good theoretical account of ethical progress. So many people would say that ethical progress occurs in a society when, in some sense to be explained, that society arrives at a moral insight that it didn't have before. So there's some, if you like, some true moral proposition, and now comes the difficult part. The society comes to recognize it. What that means is, of course, very unclear. So if you would like to think about this, there's some, you know, stone, probably quite enormous, with lots of correct moral statements written on it. And we get closer to the moral truth by learning more of these, and that counts as moral progress. That seems to me the wrong picture. I regard morality and ethics as things that develop out of a particular human past and a particular kind of human situation. And the progress consists in overcoming the limits and solving the problems posed by that complex of adapted psychological traits and a social environment. It's progress from rather than progress to. And I want to try to make sense of that.
Would it be right to say that you are trying to find a third way where the first two ways would be either regarding ethics as a kind of a science where we discover new facts about the laws of the world, on the one hand, and on the other hand, regarding ethics as just a fashion which changes with the winds of the zeitgeist?
I like that way of putting it. I mean, I think it's obvious that we can't completely make up ethical rules as we like. On the other hand, I think this idea of a picture where we sort of mirror some moral realm in some way, we come, as it were, closer and closer to representing it correctly, is a mistake. It's not just difficult to understand what this moral realm would be like and how we might access it. It just seems to me that that's the wrong picture. I think of morality as practical. So I think of human beings as evolved animals who have a certain set of psychological capacities. And those capacities in question are ones for recognizing features of one another and coming to understand what those around us are trying to do, and to be able to respond to those in positive and sympathetic ways. that is, come to recognize their aspirations and try to act in ways that don't block them, but may further them. I used to call this in my first book on the subject altruism. I think that's too limited. I think altruism is a narrower notion than what I'm calling responsiveness. Coming to terms with other people and working in harmony with them. That's what makes chimpanzee society and bonobo society and ancestral human society work to the extent that they do. But because these capacities are highly limited, they don't work very well. And that's highly visible in the case of our evolutionary relatives, where the societies tend to be often endangered and require a lot of peacemaking on the part of the animals within them. We've gotten out of that trap by doing something. And what we did was develop morality. Initially, I think in a very, very simple and crude ways, by setting out rules that would, as it were, block and interfere with the expression of those predictable impulses that would override our responsiveness to others.
What would be an example?
Tendencies to grab more than our fair share, tendencies to thwart others in their plans that come up, say, in the context of some joint project or in the context of mating or something like that. So these things become, you know, flashpoints for repeated social tensions. And it's the social tensions that spark the turn to find a solution to this problem. And out of that come the beginnings of morality. Now, this view seems to me consonant with what we know about contemporary groups of hunter-gatherers. And it seems to me that it gives ethics the right kind of objectivity. So the relation that constitutes objectivity isn't that between picture and the part of the world of which that is a picture, or mirroring reality. It's not like that. It's like lock and key. The objectivity is the ability of the key, if you like, to open the lock. So that's the source of the third word, right?
So morality is not like science or like fashion too, it's more like technology.
Yes, exactly. In my earlier book, I described it as a form of social technology. And it springs from something very deep in ourselves. I mean, the fact that we have this responsiveness to others draws us to one another, brings us together. And then we have this sort of society which is immensely fragile because that responsiveness is limited. And out of that, we can either do what so many groups of primates do, muddle along and engage in lots of time-consuming peacemaking and hope that it doesn't fall apart, or we can introduce what you rightly called a technology, and that technology is morality.
I really like the way that you used David Hume and Thomas Hobbes as to exemplify two polarities that you don't completely agree with, but which both have realized something important about the human condition, about human nature, that drives us towards this social technology of ethics. Could you like to just talk a little bit about that?
I'm going to amend it, but I think that's basically an astute way of looking at things. My paradigm case of somebody who thinks about human responsiveness to other human beings is not actually Hume, it's Adam Smith, whom I think is more sophisticated on this than Hume was. Hume is a famous sort of sentimentalist, but Smith is actually, I think, really, really insightful in seeing something important. He sees the ways in which our sympathies have to extend in many different directions. And so for him, what we are often required to do is to figure out in a social context how these sympathies are to be weighed against one another. Some of the deepest problems in our moral life come up when, not when we fail to sympathize entirely, but when we have too many sympathies. Against that, there's of course the Hobbesian side, the times when we are so committed to our own interests and our own advancement that sympathy doesn't come into play. So we've got this sort of double psychology, this psychology that is part Smithian and part Hobbesian. And out of that come, as it were, the problems that give rise to the moral project and later on to the ethical project. And we solve it in the most straightforward and direct way through actually doing what's the obvious thing to do when you have a bunch of people with different sympathies and being pulled and tugged in different directions. And so, and also having the Hobbesian selfishness underneath. And that is, get them all together and try to figure out how you can satisfy everybody. That, I think, is the fundamental method of moral inquiry.
So would it be correct to describe the view as saying that people like Smith, people like Hume, are absolutely correct in that we have natural sympathies for one another? We are naturally social, pro-social creatures. But the people like Hobbes are correct in noting that, well, not enough for that to be the only basis of our living together. And that really is where morality comes into play. It comes into play as something we build on top of our natural niceness as a way to solve the limitations of that natural niceness.
I think that's pretty good. And that's nice because it gets into the picture the idea that we're never going to do this perfectly. But that's why it's important to think about progress, not progress towards a, you know, some vast and distant goal, but progress from the bad situations that we find ourselves in to better situations. So there's this famous line that Martin Luther King stole from a 19th century, I think he was an abolitionist preacher, which is, in King's version, it's the arc of history bends towards justice. I would amend that. The arc of history bends away from injustice.
Yes, so the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends away from injustice.
That's right. Yes.
Well, I think the obvious problem that we face is that if we're talking about technology to solve problems, that emerge in us living together as social animals, how do we define a problem? And when we have different problems, how do we know the bigger from the smaller problem? I mean, Amiya Srinivasan gives the example in her response to your book of white nationalists regarding that they have problems they want to solve. And the way to solve them is to stop all refugees from being accepted into that country. Whatever our judgment on that example is, there is bound to be these issues where there are conflicting problems and we have to find the bigger from the smaller. How do you do that?
That's the difficult problem. It's actually Amiya, in a review of the first book, The Ethical Project, who set me on the path towards thinking about things this way. I mean, her review, she made some very interesting, I'm not convinced by all of them, but I've certainly been moved by some of them, criticisms of things I'd said in my book, The Project. But towards the end of her review, she said, you know, there's something here which, you know, even if all this critical stuff I've said is right, is important and points towards a different way of thinking about ethics. And it was this idea that of methods of moral inquiry. So we need to think in terms of a method for identifying problems, rating their urgency, and solving them. And I'm going to say, okay, what's the lock? And the lock is failures of responsiveness. How do you solve that? By representing everybody, by trying to set up conditions in which everybody can come to terms and understand and recognize the perspectives of others, what's driving them to say and do the things that they say and do, and that is as well informed as possible. We are never going to be able to do this perfectly. Never. But we can make progress with doing that. So we can replace what I think of as the messy and bloody, time-wasting and utterly contingent processes out of which moral progress has historically been produced, by something that is, shall we say, more reasonable. It won't be perfect, but it'll be more reasonable. And that's the idea of the kind of conversation in which we develop or try to develop this kind of responsiveness to one another. Now, with actual white supremacists and actual refugees, I doubt very much that however hard you try to impose conditions right now, you're going to be able to get a route to consensus on what the problem is and which problems are bigger than which problems. On the other hand, I think what we could expect to do is to get some members of these parties to come together and actually have a much greater sense of one another. And why do I think it's possible? Because it's been done. So think about the Irish repeal of the ban on abortion. That was quite remarkable. It ended up with something like a 70-30 or 75-25. It was a very, very decisive moment at the very end. Everybody, you know, there was this very large majority in favor of repealing the ban. And there have been other cases that are relatively similar to this. There was a case in Canada where people drafted a new constitution for British Columbia. So these things can happen. And I think we can set up these situations. And it may be a matter of working with people who are open-minded and willing at least to think about listening to others. It may be a matter of setting up norms. And down the road, I think it's a matter also for the ways in which we educate our children. I wrote another book that came out last year on education, in which I apply these ideas within the educational context and start to suggest that children, from the time they're very little, 3 or 4 years old, should start planning exercises with one another, and they should get more varied and more difficult and more complicated throughout their teens and indeed throughout their adult lives as well.
What would be an example of exercises that children should do in this kind of ethical training?
Come into the classroom. There are some things that are available for them to do for the next 15 minutes. Kids, you decide. And they get initially guidance from mentors and moderators who say, now remember what Jeremy said, or remember what Sophia wanted. And they learn to find ways of compromising, of understanding what other children want and of valuing what other children want. And then later on, those exercises get more complicated. We're going to set up some rules, and now you've got to figure it out what the rules are going to be for these activities that you're going to do together, how the decisions are going to be made, so on and so forth. So there's constant practice in doing the kinds of things that you're asked to do in the kinds of conversational situations I'm envisaging. You're teaching children to listen to one another, and then you're teaching them to try to reflect on whether they should simply try to go ahead and impose their own wants on the other person. I mean, this is in a certain very obvious sense, it's thoroughly familiar, because this is actually what we often try to do. It's just that this thrusts into the educational context something that is often done within the family, privately, unsystematically, and so on.
What about something of a utilitarian, consequentialist, welfare-based response? You've described the methodology of reaching an agreement on which problem is larger and which problem is not, what is actually a problem. Why not simply say, well, problem is greater or smaller to the extent that it involves suffering of the relevant parties?
Well, we sometimes will say that, but in order to get to applying that in practice, we're going to have this kind of procedure. So I was inclined to think of my earlier suggestions as being a certain species of consequentialism, But that's because I agree with what Bernard Williams said a very long time ago, that consequentialism is a house with many mansions, so many, in fact, that it can accommodate any moral theory.
Let's change direction a little bit. So in the 80s, you became one of the most well-known critics of what was then called sociobiology, which according to many people has now been rebranded as evolutionary psychology. I'm not sure if you agree with the view that they are basically the same project, but would you like to first, before we go into the criticism, would you like to just briefly give your own view on what sociobiology was? What was the brief history of sociobiology?
So sociobiology grew out of important advances in evolutionary theory in the 1960s, as it applied to all sorts of organisms, and in particular to social organisms. And it originally introduced evolutionary models for understanding the behavior of a variety of organisms and the structures of the societies in which they lived, in the social cases. And in the 1970s, that became increasingly connected with human behavior. I was opposed to human sociobiology, which seemed to me to generate not entirely well-grounded conclusions that were politically problematic. So it assumed ingrained genetic differences between the sexes. It assumed that there was a fixed and unalterable xenophobic disposition that human beings have that inevitably gives rise to various kinds of conflict. It postulated social hierarchies in human beings as a kind of inevitable consequence. So it was this sort of rather gloomy, pessimistic picture that was at odds with various kinds of politically reformist movements. You know, you can't possibly do it, because Darwinian evolution tells you it can't be done. Famous remark by the extraordinarily gifted, eminent scientist E.O. Wilson, who died recently, but a very great scientist, probably the major student of social insect behavior of all time. Wilson committed himself to some of these claims, often with a rather sort of sad, he didn't delight in the fact, but he said, you know, you can't push against the grain of human nature. This movement excited a lot of criticism on the part of radical and progressive evolutionary biologists, some of whom were Wilson's colleagues, but who protested enormously against it.
People like Stephen Jay Gould, I guess.
Stephen Jay Gould, Dick Lewontin. There were others too. Dick, who also died recently, was a major critic of human sociobiology. And he, with Leon Kamin and Stephen Rose, wrote a powerful book called Not in Our Genes. So this sort of criticism went on in the early part of the 1980s. Dick's book came out in 1984. I reviewed it, Think for Nature. And then my own came out in 1985. My own is called Vaulting Ambition, Sociobiology and the Quest for Human Nature. So, I mean, the human has to be in there. Because as I pointed out, an extraordinarily large amount of the work that was done on non-human animals was beautiful and rigorous and illuminating. And indeed, so, you know, you had this group of biologists who started doing wonderful studies, in Wilson's case of social insects, but there were many, many good examples. And my book attempted to celebrate those and then show how you get this leap to a far less rigorous and a far more sort of provocative and at the same time ungrounded approach in the case of human behavior. So my title, of course, comes from Macbeth, who says at one point, I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, save only vaulting ambition that o'erleaps itself and falls on the other. And that was absolutely perfect for me because, you know, it's at this point that Macbeth is deciding whether or not he's going to kill the King of Scotland, Duncan. And he introduces this image of leaping. And it was a leap. My book concludes by praising Wilson indirectly. I think the last line is, after all, to be Thane of Cawdor is no mean thing. And by that, I meant to point to Wilson's great distinction in being the principal social insect theorist, not only of his own generation, but of all time. But he wanted more. He wanted to be the one who really explained human behavior. And I was saying, no. That was the mistake, just as Macbeth's mistake was to decide to murder his king rather than remaining content with the honors that the king had already given.
So could we look at some of the problematic claims one by one? I mean, one, I think David Barash, for example, was the one you picked up as the most forceful exponent of the view that racism and xenophobia must be in our genes.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
I want to be very careful here. I cannot claim to know that what Barash says is false. What I do know is that his evidence for it is pathetically skimpy. You know, he basically drums up a sort of, you know, some quasi-evolutionary argument. He makes up a story about how it would have been advantageous to our ancestors to distrust people in other groups. And then that gets projected onto xenophobia. And when you look at the story, it's full of holes. I mean, again and again and again, I take the sort of the models, which are often only sketched by the human sociobiologists like Barash, and I show how they make very specific assumptions. And if you twiddle with the assumptions, then you get different results. I think by the mid-1980s, I would say that human sociobiology was in ruins. There was then a period of about 3 years in which people fell back and regrouped. And there were two groups that came out immediately after that. There was a group of evolutionary anthropologists, many of whom owed their allegiance to a less prominent person who contributed to human sociobiology, namely Richard Alexander. So the evolutionary anthropologists, by and large, have been much more cautious. Then there were the evolutionary psychologists, and the movement really took off from the work of Leda Cosmides and John Tooby at Santa Barbara. And often that's called the Santa Barbara paradigm in evolutionary psychology. Steven Pinker is a, you know, very prominent disciple, and there are many others. And this is what captures a lot of the public attention. And I have to say, it's flawed in the ways that I argued that Wilson's version of human sociobiology was flawed.
There's often this assumption that we can pretty much guess the natural history, the relevant natural history. We can pretty much know, for example, that xenophobia would have been useful for our ancestors. And then if we find any instance of it, then that supports the story.
Yep.
And I think the very core of Darwin's thinking was captured in the very beautiful phrase of how endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. And that presumes that, well, this mechanism, this Darwinian mechanism, can produce a vast array of different kinds of creatures. And I think a really good example of this would be chimpanzees and bonobos. Yep. These are very, very close to each other, the creatures. They live in very similar ecologies, which have some differences. Chimpanzees have all these traits that the Santa Barbara school would like to probably point out as xenophobic, and bonobos tend to lack them. And so we don't know where humans fit in that picture, but I'm not sure what the evolutionary account there could even potentially add if it's not done with specific references to human natural history.
Yeah, I think that's a very good set of observations. I mean, there's a lot, it seems to me there's a lot that's problematic here. There's one feature of this whole trend that we haven't mentioned yet that relates to the first part of our conversation, because Wilson, at the end of his sociobiology book, famously said the time has come for ethics to be removed from the hands of the philosophers and biologicized. And so he proposed both in the last chapter and later on in his book On Human Nature, and then later on with the philosopher Michael Ruse, an evolutionary account of human morality. And variants on that have been extremely influential. And I criticize that at the end of my book, but that's exactly what drove me eventually to write The Ethical Project. I would never have ventured into ethics, I think, if there hadn't been, from 1985 on, a little voice in my ear saying, okay, so that's not the way that human morality or human moral impulses evolved. How did it happen? Eh? You know, you criticize somebody else's story, but can you tell a good one? Can you give an account of this? And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and thought about it over many, many years. And it took me a long, long time and a great many sort of side turnings and explorations of various issues. And then I finally came up with my own version, which is in its way a form of evolutionary psychology. But it's not a, this is how things happened. This is a way we could have gotten morality going.
The claim that makes people most uncomfortable that typically comes out of human sociobiology when popularized, or evolutionary thinking in general when popularized, is, well, I think it was well summarized by Richard Dawkins in the first edition to The Selfish Gene. He said that we are born selfish. And yep. He did later say that that was a rogue sentence that the reader should mentally delete, but it stays in the book, and the book became probably the most influential science book of the century. So it's not a small thing. I think that it's clear by now that there are an abundance of reasons why it is not clear, just from pure evolutionary logic, that we would in any meaningful sense have to be selfish. There are many ways in which being unselfish can be useful for evolution. There are many reasons why we are not optimized to be perfect for evolution, et cetera, et cetera. So why is it that you find people as intelligent, as remarkable scientists as Richard Dawkins, who are so, like you say, that's so careful in their work on non-human animals, easily jump into making this very precise claim? Like, so many of these different schools, even if they disagree on a lot of other things, a lot of people at some point in their career make the statement one way or another that we must be born selfish. Or like Michael Giselin, who was a very big critic of E.O. Wilson, for example, he also said that scratch an altruist and watch a hypocrite bleed.
Watch a hypocrite bleed, exactly.
Yes. So where does it come from, this urge to converge on this Hobbesian view? Darwin did not share this view, for example.
I think it works this way. I mean, I think there's a tremendous impatience on the part of some scientists. And I think Dawkins actually shares this with philosophers. I mean, he famously said, you know, philosophers are useless, but then there's Dan Dennett. And so Dennett restored his faith that philosophy was good for something. And I can see why. Dan Dennett's a very interesting thinker and, you know, has done an enormous amount, I think, to bring all sorts of philosophical issues to a wide audience. And Dawkins really, you know, likes what Dennett stands for and what he does. But, you know, Dawkins and others like him read ethical discussions and they get very impatient with them. They go back to attempts to understand the origins of society or the origins of ethical thought that are put forward by people like Hobbes and Locke and Hume and Rousseau. And they say, well, look, these guys are really—they're really smart. They've got the right idea. They want to try to understand where it all comes from. But now we know. Thanks to Darwin, we can do this. Now, Darwin was himself much more modest, as you point out. I think what happened was that the successes of theoretical biology in the 1960s, the work of Hamilton, of George Williams, of John Maynard Smith, inspired Dawkins. Now we have the tools, we can do it. And what we find out is Hobbes is basically right.
That's what evolution teaches us. Yes, there are examples of altruistic behavior, yes, but in fact, they're not that common. And in any case, even when somebody seems to be an altruist, there's a hypocrite bleeding underneath who is actually doing everything for future representation in the next generations or two. So that idea has become completely dominant. It is, as many people have pointed out, I'm one of them, it is an interesting confusion of the biological notion of evolution, of altruism, with the psychological notion of altruism. A biological altruist is one who sacrifices reproductive success to enhance the reproductive success of another. A psychological altruist is someone who, well, adjusts behavior to realize the desires of another at possible cost to himself or herself. That has nothing to do with reproduction or fitness or representation in future generations. It involves an intention.
I think for me, for my money, one of the easiest thought experiments to demonstrate that this doesn't work. I mean, there's plenty of very theoretical reasons why it doesn't work, but I think a very easy way to wrap our head around it is to think about artificial selection. And let's say that we run an artificial selection study where we handpick people who show tendencies towards niceness from very early on. And then we breed them. And I mean, something along these lines have been done, for example, in the Siberian silver fox experiments with silver foxes. You know, you always pick the nicest ones each generation, and you start having something of a very dog-like breed of foxes who are very playful, etc. Now, it seems clear that these foxes, to the extent that they are actually nice to humans. I mean, they're not nice to humans to be selected to the next breeding round. I mean, there's no way that they could be aware of right. logic. I mean, they're just right. nice, period. And then they get selected, and selection happens after these phenotypes emerge. That's an example from artificial selection, but it doesn't change, you know, whatever has been the selective pressure, if there has been one, for niceness. Well, it doesn't mean that people are nice to fit into that selective pressure, as if we were all subconscious Darwinian wizards who kind of know exactly what we're trying to do. And that seems to be kind of your criticism to Richard Alexander's program, is that, and that is some why I feel sometimes uneasy with his writings, that he sometimes seems to think that we are very, very good in our subconsciousness in yes. knowing what is going to maximize our fitness. And there's some mystical mechanism that drives us to always think about subconsciously.
Yeah, actually, I think, I mean, as I've said, I think Alexander's version of human sociobiology was gentler and more subtle in some ways than Wilson's. And it's interesting because it's the anthropologists who follow him. I'm inclined to think that that's responsible for the relative merits of evolutionary anthropology over Santa Barbara style evolutionary psychology. But yes, I think what you said is actually quite insightful about, you know, the postulation of this sort of, you know, we're tuned to Darwin's logic in some mysterious way, maybe through our subconscious.
Too much credit. It almost gives a bit too much credit to the skills of our subconsciousness in calculating. But I would want to actually push back a little bit on your criticism towards Wilson. I think that a lot of the individual claims that you take up in Vaulting Ambition, I generally felt very at ease with. But I must say I'm a bit more sympathetic to some of the general ideas that Wilson has about the potential role of human nature playing in our view of humanity. I mean, the metaphor was something like genes hold the culture on a leash. And I can see that in many cases he tried to do this, he might have failed, but I'm not so convinced that this is a bad idea in the first place. I mean, I can see a good example of where this is not the case. Is, for example, pandas. Pandas live solitary lives in the wild. And so somebody who just analyzes their evolution says, oh, they've become very solitary creatures. Also, they can never live in groups. Then you put them in zoos and they're playing all day around with each other. They're very happy yep. social animals. So clearly in many animals, there's kind of flexibility to live a different form of life than is encoded in your genes. But what about if I just throw the example of attachment theory to you? When John Bowlby was hugely, Darwin was very influential in Bowlby's career, and Bowlby came up with this idea from very loose evolutionary speculation, but he came up with this idea, which then later was tested in many ways, that is very important for infants to have some sense of security with a caregiver. And nowadays it's been modified many ways. I think Sarah Hardy's work has shown that it's not necessarily just about having one mom. It might be useful to have a few people around, etc. But I think that there's something really beautiful about the idea. And there is a sense in which, to the extent that Bowlby was right, there is our genes do hold culture on a leash. And you have examples, I mean, I think a very banal but helpful example is Nazi Germany, where there was a very conscious effort to do what in a Bowlbian sense was to break this attachment. There's a famous child rearing manual by Johann Harer, where you explicitly show to mothers how you should hold your baby at an arm's length and not basically do everything in a way that Bowlby would tell you not to do. And I think it's a reasonable suggestion that is harmful to human health. In a way, yes, you can try to do this, but the genes will in a way fight back. There is a sense in which humans strive for that connection, and there's something fighting back. So what do you make of that example?
Well, I mean, I think what I want to say about this is, well, of course, Bowlby was not reasoning particularly rigorously. He guessed, and he got it right. I don't think we know that, but I think we've got some basis for thinking that it might be true. But does that really sort of justify going around playing evolutionary guessing games, especially when some of these evolutionary guessing games may have profoundly damaging social consequences? I don't think so. This is an area into which, if you're going to say something that is really going to cause suffering for some group, especially for a group that has had a lot of suffering to deal with in its past, you better have pretty strong evidence. You don't want to do it on the basis of guesswork. Now, Bowlby was, in a certain sense, harmless. So it was, as it were, protected. It was a protected space into which he could afford to make his evolutionary guesses. So far, they seem to have panned out. That doesn't license Wilson from going around saying, you know, the genes hold culture on a leash. That encourages people thinking that the genes will hold culture on a leash with respect to aspects of the human phenotype that they want to change, and which might be changeable, and that change might be for the better.
Before we end, Professor Kitcher, you're a secular humanist. You've identified as such. You've written about secular humanism. What is secular humanism for you?
Secular humanism is an attempt to understand ourselves and understand the value of being human and understand the human project without thinking in religious terms. It's to try to not simply to deny what religious teachings say, not simply to be an atheist, a naysayer, but to provide the kind of positive vision that religions at their best provide. So there's a sense in which secular humanism respects things in religion. It doesn't follow the path of the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins and Dan Dennett and others, who really want to sweep religion away as noxious trash that has to be got rid of as quickly as possible. The secular humanist says, look, religion can have great value, can also do great harm, but at its best, it gives people a view by which to live. It enriches their lives in various ways. And the secular humanist is somebody who finds alternative, non-religious ways to do the same kind of thing. So the challenge for a secular humanist is to develop a worldview that gives a place to values, gives a place to morality, gives a place to ethics, and gives a place for meaning in life. And that's the kind of secular humanist I want to be. And you may not know of my most recent attempt to tangle with these issues. It occurs in my book on education, where I talk about religious education, which I see the secular humanist not just as able to ally with people of, you know, who think that religion is something non-literal, that it's something that talks about some transcendent aspect of life, but actually with a broader class of religious believers, with anybody who accepts what I think of as Kant's fundamental insight, which is the priority of value over religion, that you cannot see religion as the source of ethical or moral values, or indeed of any such values. Since, as Kant puts it so beautifully, in order to recognize the Holy One of Israel, I must already have a conception of what is right and wrong. I must already have a moral sense. And that's exactly correct, it seems to me, that if you think, well, the deity has to be obeyed, whatever he tells us, you're in the position of the Nazi commandant who, as it were, follows the instructions that come down from the Führer or the Führer's deputies to run the camp. Well, the Führer is more powerful than I was, and sees further than I do. And so that lets you off the hook. No, it doesn't let you off the hook. We all know it. Now, there are lots of religious believers who hold to Kant's insight, who realize full and well that whatever the Bible says, they shouldn't go around, you know, slaying their neighbors and smiting them and collecting the foreskins and all that, and rounding up the nubile young women and so on and so forth. And equally that they shouldn't love their neighbors, because by doing so they will heap coals of fire on the heads of their enemies. I mean, that's, you know, they know that. They think that the doctrines of their religion are uniquely correct and that the doctrines of a rival religion are not correct. I think they're completely wrong about that. I think everybody has it wrong, unless they go completely non-literalist about it. But I can make an alliance with people who accept Kant's insight, because we can, as it were, limit the role of religion where it hurts most, which is when religion is wheeled into an important moral debate as a conversation stopper, as something that, as it were, shuts things off and declares that what comes out of a text has to be the law or the moral or imperative or whatever. So my views have evolved a little bit, and I now no longer see the secular humanist as, you know, like the runner who's finished the race, gotten to the end, and sees, you know, the really enlightened religious believers who are completely ecumenical. We're all trying to chart the transcendent realm, and the Buddhists do it differently from the Hindus, who do it differently from the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims, but we're all basically on the same page. And this person is approaching the tape, and the secular humanist is standing there saying, come on, you're so close. You almost got it right. I no longer take that attitude, which was the attitude of my lectures on secular humanism, Life After Faith. It seems to me that's arrogant. I think that secular humanism and religion actually can co-evolve with one another. I think there are some things that religion can learn from secular humanism. I also think that secular humanism can learn a lot from various forms of religion. So I think there should be a more humble alliance between what we might think of as the moderate middle, the ecumenical Christians who are prepared to accept Kant's insight, their you know, counterparts among Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and so forth. We are different from literalist fundamentalists, for whom, you know, Bible says it and that settles it. Or on the other hand, the militant atheists who think that this is just rubbish. We don't need these worldviews. We don't need, you know, ethics is just a delusion anyway. We're all selfish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Both of these extreme positions, I think, bad, and they're bad for the polity. And I'd like to see a big alliance of the middle. So I'm getting to be a more sympathetic and warmer and fuzzier secular humanist.
You know, you mentioned Dan Dennett earlier as an example of the more religion is trash camp. And that is it. Certainly the view that that is easy to have of him. But I bumped into something really interesting. Very recently, Dennett had an interview with the great physicist, Sean Carroll, from Caltech. And I was really surprised at what he said. If you don't mind, I'm gonna just read a few lines from their discussion. So Dennett says that he's going to quote a line from Robert Frost. Robert Frost says that home is where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. Now, in that sense, there's a lot of people that are homeless and don't trust the state to take care of them. One of the things that religions have done over the decades, over the millennia, is taken in and provided a sense of meaning and love for people who otherwise would not have that. This is a life-healing, life-protecting, life-improving feature of the world that we don't want to throw away. The question is, how do you save it without also saving the sort of brute irrationality and irrationality, the valorization of unreason and superstition? I think it's possible to domesticate religions a little further. They've been domesticated a lot, but I think we can go a little further and keep the ceremony, keep the community, keep music and art and celebration intact, and leave out the myths. I was quite surprised by this.
I'm very surprised, since Dan actually wrote for a volume about me, and we had one of our usual disagreements about this. He once gave me a nice title. He pointed me the Pope of the I'm an Atheist But movement. And so, you know, I feel that sort of the disagreement between us always has been like that between, you know, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, that I'm more sympathetic, more understanding of bits and pieces of religion than he is. But it sounds as though he's coming in my direction. This is an unusual trend, I think, but I haven't seen it before. So I'm delighted to know this.
Well, speaking of Bolsheviks, Marx's famous line about religion is that religion is opium for the people. Now, you make a great observation. I think it was in Life After Darwin, that Marx was not talking about opium, religion being opium, only as a recreational drug, but also as a medicinal drug.
That's right. It's the point that Dan just made about taking people in. I mean, the poor and the distressed and the humiliated and the, you know, the outcast need help. They need something to help them. And I think that Marx was just saying, that's medicine. It's medicine that can, as it were, dull the edge of pain. And Dan was actually appreciating in the lines you just read.
Well, there is a lot of research on health effects of religion, on reduced mortality just from attending religious sermons once a week. There's research on people being drawn towards religions when they feel unsafe. So if we imagine a world where we have moved, whether we want or not, let's say that the world has moved beyond religion for one reason or another, what will be the medicinal drug that will replace religion? Will it be, I mean, I coming from Finland, of course, I appreciate that the state can do many things that it doesn't do in other countries, but I don't necessarily, also coming from Finland, wouldn't say that this Nordic welfare state is all that people need and then they can have a happy life thereafter.
Yeah. This goes back to what I was saying about the coevolution of religion and secular humanism. I think that secular humanists need to provide proper responsive community measures, institutions that will do the things that religion has done for people, especially for those who suffer. I mean, I've said to Dan many, many times in conversations and even in sort of public fora, you know, wander up into Harlem, wander up sort of 10 blocks from where I live, and you see all these little storefront churches and meeting places. They're doing a lot of good. Riverside Church just up the street is doing a lot of good. There are lots of places near where I live that are really taking the edge off people's lives. Now, I have also been to meetings at places like the Society for Ethical Culture, which are conceived as doing the same kind of thing. And they try terribly hard, but it doesn't work as well. It's not as effective. And we have to learn that. I mean, there are people in various parts of the world. I know there's a humanist university in Holland, in Utrecht, where they do fabulous work at trying to help train humanist chaplains who will go out and do the pastoral care and the pastoral work that, you know, rabbis and Christian pastors and, you know, Muslim leaders have tried to do, and in the Abrahamic religions and so on and so forth. And it's very, very difficult. I mean, in a certain sense, the Abrahamic religions have had many, many centuries of experimenting with this kind of institutional framework. They have a lot to teach those of us who are just starting out. And, you know, we have to learn that. It's very important that we learn that, because these are important things. And I sensed in what you read that Dan was starting to acknowledge that. I think that he and Dawkins and Hitchens and Sam Harris, I think that they think that believing what is truly false or, from their point of view, absurd is the worst thing that can ever happen to a person. It isn't. There are far worse things that can happen. Some of these false things, and even reasoning in ways that Dan would call irrational or unreasonable or crazy, if that actually mitigates all of the things that the world, the hostile world, throws at you and makes it possible for you to live and for you to contribute to the lives of people you love, those false beliefs are worth having. The challenge is to substitute for those false beliefs things that can be, as it were, epistemically more benign, but still have the same kind of practical effects. And we don't know how to do that yet. That's the secular humanist project to work on.
Professor Kitcher, based on your research, based on your worldview, what kind of animals are we?
Well, I'm actually in the process of writing a book that has a title that sort of speaks to that question. I think we shouldn't call ourselves Homo sapiens. We're not wise. I don't think we should even call ourselves Homo cognoscens. We're not knowing. I think we should call ourselves Homo quirens. We're the animal that inquires. And learning how to do that better is, I think, the heart of philosophy as I understand it. Learning how to do it with respect to value issues and all of the other domains in which inquiries are needed. So, Homo quirens.
Philip Kitcher, thank you very much.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed this interview.
This was the second episode of the On Humans podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider also checking my first conversation with philosopher Patricia Churchland. Also, do consider sharing the episode with someone you think would like it, and especially just subscribing to it. This way you will also be notified of future episodes, such as one coming up with the anthropologist Douglas P. Fry, a specialist in the prehistory and in the origins of war, and someone who thinks that sloppy evolutionary theorizing might have led us astray in this topic. Thank you, as always, for listening. Take care.